There she goes.
The Senate Interim Committee and Finance Revenue Committee is open, and we are assembled. It's just an information hearing. For an informational hearing.
Ready?
Yeah.
Good morning. I am now convening the House Interim Committee on Revenue for our informational meeting.
So with us assembled, let's get right to it. Josh Lerner, Mark McMullen for our quarterly economic revenue forecast. Gentlemen? And joining us on the phone, I believe, Representative Smith, are you there?
I am, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let's put my phone on mute.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. For the record, my name is Mark McMullen, the Oregon State Economist, joined as always by my colleague, Josh Lerner. So this quarterly forecast is really the kickoff for the 1921 budget process. This is going to be the first time that our numbers for 1921 are actually used by policymakers in the form of drafting the governor's recommended budget. So a lot of the stuff we're going to talk about today is really focused on that next two-year budget period. And this is what we really did a lot of work with our advisory groups on. It makes, from a forecasting perspective, it makes a lot of sense if we're going to make any philosophical sea changes or anything like that in the forecast in terms of our methodology or any of our assumptions. It makes sense to do that now so that the governor's office and the legislature in May will be working with roughly the same numbers, we hope. They get a lot of things can happen, they can change between now and then, but in terms of philosophical ways of thinking, we kind of like to do that now. And so,
welcome to Verizon Wireless.
No.
The number you dialed has been changed, disconnected, or is no longer in service.
Here we go.
If you feel you have reached this recording an error, please check the number.
Yeah, I think we have.
We lost service.
So we might have lost Representative Smith. So at any rate, going forward, there are quite a bit of headwinds in terms of the outlook. But for the near term, in terms of the economic outlook, it's pretty stable. And there's really, in terms of where to get out of this current biennium where we're at, the 17-19 budget period, the economy is probably going to hold up. For most of most of the data flow is still relatively healthy. When we look at leading indicators, we look at all the, we throw a bunch of data together. Our traditional models aren't built to forecast turning points in the economy, when things are going to go south or when they're going to boom. They're more trying to catch the trend growth. And so to figure out a turning point, if Oregon's economy is going south within the next several months, one of the tools we lean on are our leading indicator series, where you take all sorts of noisy data. You know, everything is correlated with the economy a little bit. The standard joke of the stock market has predicted 7 of the last 4 recessions, things like that. There are a lot of data like that aren't by themselves a very reliable indicator, but if you throw them all together and see if there's a lot of negative chatter or positive chatter together, would suggest, can be pretty predictive, at least in the near term. And that's what we've done, and the University of Oregon has done, put together indices that are trying to guess, okay, are we looking at some kind of downturn within the next 6-month period? And so far, no, according to our data flow. We're not seeing a lot of negative things. There are a few negative things. Housing starts or home permits have stalled out a little bit. They're still at a higher level than they were a couple, 3 years ago. But we've stopped seeing growth, and in the multifamily, we've actually seen some pullback in the permitting activity. And then we've also seen a few other, a couple other things that are softening, and a lot of them may have to do with some of the issues around trade and tariffs that are going on. In particular, we've seen some softening in temporary workers, employment services that are used by manufacturers, and we've also seen a little softening in hours worked among non-durable manufacturers, particularly our food manufacturing industry throughout the valley. This might just be data at this point in terms of the
hours worked for the manufacturers, and particularly the food industry, but it does fit the narrative insofar as many of our firms now are increasingly dependent upon bringing in supplies from abroad to package them here. In the past, Oregon's food packaging industry, you know, was really very highly seasonal, dependent on when our crops were coming in, and now we've kind of filled out a lot of the dead season by pulling in crops from abroad. And so we and indicators of dollar strength and the like might suggest that there are some issues in terms of trade maybe weighing down in the future. And the last thing that we see that might not be so positive is in the semiconductor industry, where one of our leading indicators is the book-to-bill ratio for semiconductor equipment manufacturers, which means how many machines that make semiconductors are being sold or being ordered. And so this is a leading indicator, because if you're going to ramp up production, first you have to buy the equipment to do so. And this has been soft as well recently. But all told, in terms of this next, you know, year or so, in terms of the economic forecast, it's pretty stable. I wish I could say the same thing for the revenue forecast over the next year, but we'll revisit that when we get to the revenue section. But the real issue then becomes, in terms of the economy, it's really looking forward into that 1921 period, where we are seeing a wide range of headwinds that suggest that growth will slow.
I think it was something you said about the semiconductor industry.
Yes.
Technologically.
So as we head into this, this is where we're really starting to have some uncertainty in terms of that 1921, is really the nature of the slowdown. We know there's a lot of headwinds that the macroeconomy is going to hit. We've got the demographics and an aging labor force. We have capacity constraints, as we're, you know, very low unemployment and the like, where it's hard to find workers and supplies. And we also have, you know, fiscal and monetary policy coming off at the federal level. So we feel strongly that over the medium term, we're going to transition down to a slower growth rate at the U.S. that's more sustainable over the long haul. The problem is, you know, we don't know the path that we're going to take to get there. Whether or not we're going to have a gradual slowdown, whether or not we're going to have a couple of years of boom followed by bust or the like. And given that we're really focused on this two-year window in 1921, that pattern and that path make all the difference in terms of how strong we expect the state revenues to be. So with that, I'm going to pass it to Josh to dig in a little bit deeper on this economic outlook for the next 2 years.
Thanks, Mark. For the record, Chair Haas, Chair Davidson, members of the committee, Josh Lehner, Office of Economic Analysis. And as Mark was saying, right, we have a lot of factors working to slow growth over the next few years, next 2, 3, 4 years. We're expecting growth to slow at the national level. The question is, how much will it slow? And to the extent that, is there a possibility that we'll slow far enough that policy will become such a drag on the outlook that we maybe even tip into a recession during the 1921 or even 21-23 bienniums? And the hard thing to know is, when exactly will that pattern occur? Right now, a recession is not seen in the data. And trying to forecast a recession 2 or 3 years in advance is a fool's errand. There's just too much time between now and 2 or 3 years down the road, too many variables, too many policy levers that can be pulled to adjust the outlook. But right now, as Mark was saying, the Federal Reserve interest rate hikes are working to slow growth. And if you look into the Fed's communication, you look at the market expectations of federal interest rate hikes, they're going to raise rates next month, and then probably three times in 2019, maybe one more in 2020. All these interest rate hikes after a year or two work to slow the economy. There's a long time lag associated with an interest rate hike today, cooling activity in the future. And so the full brunt of 4 years of interest rate hikes will be working to cool the U.S. economy by 2020, 2021. And then on top of that, you layer federal policies where the tax cuts. We cut taxes by a good amount in 2018, a little bit more in 2019 in terms of fully implementing the tax cuts on their impact on the economy. But by 2020, we're not cutting taxes anymore. And so that turns from a mathematical boost to economic growth to a mathematical drag as you know, the chain CPI starts to eat into some of the tax cuts. And then eventually by 2025, all the personal provisions in the code as of written today, as of the legislation today, reverse. And then we have a big tax increase a handful of years down the road, provided federal policymakers don't change course. So we have monetary policy cooling the economy, fiscal policy acting as a drag as the big spending package that was just negotiated last year comes to an end. And we're expecting slower growth as the economy reaches its capacity constraints, as Mark was discussing. So what do you do as a forecaster? What we've done in our office is expect a gradual slowdown in the Oregon economy. 2019 will be another solid to good year of economic growth. You can think about it as our job growth will be above potential, more than enough to meet population growth, labor force participation gains, and the unemployment rate will go a little bit lower. 2020, our growth will slow a little bit to around potential. We're at about as many jobs as we need to keep pace with labor force participation rates and population growth and migration trends and all that sort of underlying growth in the population and labor force of Oregon's economy. 2020, 21, 2022 and beyond, we're looking for a little bit slower than that, where the economy is harder to find workers, it's harder for businesses to expand, they're running out of office space and warehouse space and things like that, so they have to invest more time and money and energy to overcome some of these hurdles to growth. What we're not doing in our underlying forecast is putting in a recession hedge in 2020, 2021, as some U.S. forecasters are starting to do. They're seeing that weakness on the horizon, and they're basically taking growth from where we are today almost down to zero or 0.5%, maybe 1% at most, in 2020, 2021 time period. It's sort of a neither here nor there forecast. Instead of seeing a slow tapering of growth as the economy reaches its capacity constraints, they're basically saying, we think there's a larger chance of a significant slowdown and possible recession 3 years out, and they're taking that growth all the way down to hardly anything in the expectations that maybe a full-blown recession is possible on the horizon. That is a scenario that more U.S. forecasters are discussing over the course of the last year because the risks have been heightened given the nature of a mature business cycle and the federal policies that are in current law.
Thanks, Josh. And just to add, so our vendor as well has got, as Josh described it, a recessionary hedge or a neither here nor there forecast that's underlying their U.S. outlook. And we're reluctant to do that, keeping growth a little stronger in the near term than and pushing off the, and making the slowdown a little more gradual. Because of the, traditionally this has been a problem for our office, is right here on these turning points, it's the hardest time, or in a mature expansion, is the hardest time to do this forecast. And traditionally our office has made the mistake of going with too much of a recessionary hedge, where we have a sharp slowdown put into the revenue forecast, and when that slowdown doesn't occur as expected, then we start getting big kicker payments, and then after the big kicker payments, we are encouraged to increase our forecast, and you typically do so just before the bottom falls out. And so we miss on both ends. And as hard as it is as a forecaster, the best, you know, planning forecast would be to wait, you know, and hold on and until you see the whites of this slowdown's eyes, and then pull the Band-Aid off at once and reflect. Once we know that a recession or a slowdown is occurring, then make sure we incorporate that fully into the outlook rather than trying to do it halfway in advance. So that's the qualitatively what we're looking at in terms of the outlook. But if that does come to pass, and we still have a couple more decent years of job growth, like the baseline now suggests, that would be great for Oregon, because the longer we go with continuing to grow in this tight labor market situation, the more and more benefits are start to flow down to our workforce. And we really, really have started to see that. In the U.S., we started to see overall average wage growth just now get up in to the 3% range, and it's been growing lately, and there's been a lot of reports about that. But that just gets them up to the place where Oregon's now been for 4 years. We've been in the 3 to 4% wage growth for 4 years now, and it's starting to really become more broad-based across households of different income, across regions of the state, and the like. You know, and the, just more of this is going to happen. We're starting to see improvement in poverty rates and caseloads for our need-based health care and income maintenance programs, and the things that are the last to turn around in the good times. Once now that you know, laborers are scarce. Employers are going deeper and deeper down that pile of resumes and taking folks that may not have been as qualified as were available a couple 3 years ago, and that's doing wonderful things. And the new census data on income shows that in terms of Oregon's median income level now has caught up with and even slightly passed that of the U.S. for the median household. So that's impressive. That hasn't been the case since all the mills closed in the end of the 70s and early 80s for Oregon. And we can expect even more gains to come going forward. Now, we're still lagging. For quite some time, the business community was talking a lot about per capita income in Oregon, and that's still below the U.S. average because of the nature of our income distribution. The way Oregon's different than other states is we just don't have folks at the tippy top end, or as many of them, not the one percenters, but the 1.1% or income types that you see in the big states and the big cities with financial service industries and the like. And so in terms of averages, those folks with a tremendous amount of income really pull that average up in a lot of states, and we just don't have, we have some, but we just don't have the same number of those. But in terms of median, when you're looking, if you lined up all the households in Oregon and picked the ones in the middle for income, that median household is doing just as well as elsewhere in the country, which hasn't happened, like I say, for decades now. And so this improvement is impressive, and it's really coming through the labor market. You know, for our median household that I'm describing, really all of their income comes from wages. They don't have a whole lot in terms of investment income and the like. You know, so it's all coming from wages, and that's where we're seeing the real good stories. We're getting. Yes.
Just on that, on those two sort of mathematical issues, over the last decade or two, it was always said Oregon's problem is we're below the income average. Now, was that always referencing the median income, or was it per capita?
That was usually the per capita personal income was being referenced, but it was true that both were below here for a few decades. Now the median has caught up. Per capita, that's unlikely unless we get a stock market or something like that in the near term. But yeah, we don't, it, like I say, because of the that very high end that we don't have here.
So how, where you know, is it like 95%, 90% of the?
90%.
The, around 90.
95 now?
The low point was 90. We're up to about 94% in recent years, which is the highest we've been on a per capita personal income basis since the 2001 recession.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I think that's a pretty important number. The former LRO director always used to say, if we can, for every point you bump up in an income tax state like ours, it's literally billions of dollars. I mean, you move up that 6% to 100, it'll swamp any kind of a tax that Senator Bocas or somebody else could come up with.
No, that yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And Oregon tends to slip back on.
Just hold on. I do have one for you coming up in the session. Let's see whether you bite on that one or not.
Okay. So Oregon does slip back on these measures of relative income in our typical recession, right? It's when we're in these expansions that we make up ground, this one being a particularly transformative one. And so we've really made up a lot of ground here in this expansion. If it continues, we'll continue to make more, but may take another step back in the recession. And again, it's a lot of our that's because, you know, our wages and our labor market get hit harder. And for the median household, wages are really everything. And they've seen these gains spread across come from the labor market pretty steadily. Oops, can't quite click this. So, but the
just the mouse.
What's that?
Use the mouse.
Use the mouse. Yeah, there we go. For the underlying dynamics of household income, you see here, it's really coming from a wide range of labor market improvements. We're having more households, we're getting more workers per household as participation rises. We're getting incredible increases in the full-time workers, which means we're working more, each worker's working longer. So we're almost 4.5% there in terms of the growth in full-time year-round workers. And they're also earning more. There's the median earnings at 3%. So we have more households participating more in the labor market with for longer hours at higher rates of pay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to ask for clarification. Sometimes we're talking about Oregon's economy relative to the national economy on average or other states. Sometimes we're talking about national numbers. Can you make it clear when we're talking about Oregon's versus when we're talking about a national number or a national trend? And along those lines, when we're thinking about the labor market, can you comment briefly on the effect on migration patterns in a good economy versus a bad economy? Is Oregon experiencing more or less in migration now because we're in a good economy, or is it pretty stable?
Thank you, Chair Nathanson, and welcome aboard in this committee. I've been told by legislators before that this is one of the more entertaining presentations you guys have on your docket, which I'm sure they're just buttering us up. But if they're not, I feel for you. And hanging in there over time. But
it is interesting. Yeah,
this most recent labor force growth gains here, this is all Oregon numbers. Before, we were talking about how Oregon does vis-a-vis the U.S. Mm-hmm. here with the relative median household incomes here for both. But I'll try to make sure that's clear. Now that we have our slides up, we'll probably do a better job of framing what we're talking about. But in terms of migration, you're absolutely right. This is the primary comparative advantage for Oregon, the primary reason we have a boom-bust economy where we grow better in the expansions than other states and suffer more in our recessions has a lot to do with these migration trends. And, since the time of Lewis and Clark, whenever we have jobs here, people want to come. And that is a tremendous advantage. It's not just in terms of demand for consumer services, retail, housing, stuff like that, which is good when you bring people, but more importantly, they bring a supply of skilled labor to Oregon. And that is an amazing advantage for our firms. We don't have Stanford or MIT here, but we can get an engineer that's been trained there to come and at a discount relative to other states. And so this really remains our comparative advantage going forward. Now, we've talked about in this group before, it's also now turning into be one of our idiosyncratic risks. Because this has always been so important for us, we're keeping an eye on how this will look going forward. There are still quite a few in the millennial population cohort that are in their or close to their peak moving years. So that's a good thing, but there is a threat in terms of the price of housing and the cost of housing. One of the reasons folks moved here traditionally was an advantage in housing cost. And we still do have quite an advantage relative to California and the places where a lot of the folks come from. But nevertheless, that advantage is eroding, and there, so we are keeping an eye on whether or not, the housing supply, lack of housing supply may help pinch off some of this migration, which again is our comparative advantage.
Thank you.
So quickly breaking it down to a couple of regions and industries of note. Like I said, part of this is we've had this tight labor market and we've seen these income gains isn't just flowing down to different levels of household income, but also across regions of the state. Unfortunately, we do not have the new rural data yet.
And it'll really be a couple more years till we get the 5-year look at the from the census at a lot of our rural areas to get an idea where we are here at the top of the cycle, you know, here, because they average over 5 years. So 2022 or so, we'll really know where those are. But looking at some of the harder hit places in the Umpqua and Rogue Valleys that we do have some data for suggests that some of the good things that anecdotally we're hearing is, are certainly happening and spreading throughout the state. Much of this region, Jackson and Josephine County and the like, were some of the epicenter of the housing downturn and got hit as hard as almost anywhere else in the state during the recession. How you read these graphs is we're looking at real inflation-adjusted median income starting when the recession began and going forward to the most current period. And over the last couple of years, we've seen rapid improvement in even places like Jackson and Douglas County, where they're now back to pre-recession levels in terms of income. That's not an entirely positive story. A decade of stagnant income is still a decade of stagnant income, but the last couple, 3 years have been pretty good. And when we get newer data, we expect to see even more improvement. Josephine County there hasn't shown as much, but that might just be in the data. Very small sample size, and it jumps up and down depending on the data point. And so right now it's down, but I wouldn't be surprised to see some improvements going forward in that noisy series.
Senator Boulkhorst.
Just for clarification on Josephine County, and I know you have no empirical data, but my colleague that's to my right, that's not here, not Representative Marsh. But having said that, what we're hearing down there is that has become, and what I have seen down there and gone down there and visited, that's become quite the cash economy down there. And if it's a cash economy, your ability to track it is quite difficult. So is it not just as feasible that Josephine County might be up there in between Jackson and Douglas if it wasn't a cash economy? And we, of course, I mean, you've seen the HEDA reports, the state police reports, and everything else. And so I don't think, if you can just clarify, if it is become a cash economy, that we really have the ability to track it. So we may not know what's going on. Is it?
Senator Boulkhorst, Chair Hass, and Chair Nathanson, yeah. That is true, and it is certainly true that the data in Josephine is noisy and hard to interpret, as with a lot of the small places, but this census data is actually self-reported income. And so in terms of this data, you're asking people how much you make. And so whether they make it in cash or not, now that said, people don't always report their income to the census takers accurately. That's a problem everywhere, not just Josephine County. They do not want to, you know, fully report everything as said. But that would move in the direction. I think a lot of folks still, you know, are above board in terms of the banking and the like, you know, in terms of aggregate numbers.
Senator Boulkhorst, the one thing I would add, the Josephine County, the hard numbers we have in terms of jobs and average wages coming from the unemployment insurance records, those look good. Those look just as good as Jackson, right? So Medford turned around maybe a year first before Grants passed it in terms of job growth a handful of years ago. But Josephine County's job growth has been quite strong in the last 3 years. So that would mean, yeah, the gap, the divergence we're seeing in the household income numbers doesn't match the numbers coming from the labor market. So I also think there's a demographic component here, too, where we're having a larger and larger share of retirement age households in Josephine County. And as you know, for the vast majority of people, they earn less money in retirement than they do in their peak working years. So I think there's an underlying demographic shift that's kind of weighing on some of these top line indicators. But we haven't done a full decomposition on that.
But that's a good point. And as Josh says, in terms of the employment numbers for Grants Pass are significantly above where they were before the recession, which is quite good. And there was a national survey or a national report that came out a couple, 3 months ago saying Grants Pass had one of the five weakest regional economies in the nation, which certainly is not true. Some of these indicators don't look great, but the jobs do, and given their access to I-5 and transportation, I would certainly not bet against them going forward. Now,
And now that while things are spread out across, you know, the state now, and we're seeing growth in, you know, pretty much every region of the state, even some of our most struggling rural areas. That said, we should, you know, pause to realize just how transformative and how big a deal this expansion has been in the Portland metro area, which always tends to perform well, or certainly has in recent decades. But this one was even more so in terms of turning, you know, the emerging metropolitan area into really a center where of high productivity jobs and high productivity workers. Here we're looking at what happened in terms of the 100 largest metropolitan statistical areas, and how their income and rates of educational attainment among their peak working age cohorts, how these things changed throughout this business cycle. So from 2007, when the recession began, to 2017, the most recent data we have. And you see there are very few metropolitan areas, three or four of them, the high flyer, San Francisco, San Jose, Denver, Austin, that saw larger income gains than did Portland, and a couple, three or four that saw as large or larger increases in their rates of educational attainment. Again, some of these hotter metropolitan areas, Pittsburgh and San Jose and the like. And so this, you know, gets at what Representative Nathanson was alluding to, the importance of the migration, as we're bringing in a lot of young, educated folks who are productive workers, and this is added to the growth that we're seeing internally over time. You know, one question I always get when I put up this graph is like, well, yeah, but what degrees are we getting? Aren't they all just basket weavers that want to move to Portland, right? And that's, you know, we certainly do get our share of the basket weavers, but this is if we look at STEM degrees, you know, science and math, and extend that to healthcare degrees and the like, Portland's still right up there in the top five. Top
basket
six.
Weavers can't afford to live in Portland. It's expensive.
No, they live in Boise.
It's that 40-40-20 goal that's pushing this that we passed.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So moving on to the industry stuff, one quick technical note about price indices that this committee might have to deal with in the coming session, and then a little quick look at the large retail trade sector as we head into the holiday shopping season.
As we've discussed before, the Bureau of Labor Statistics has eliminated the Portland-Salem Consumer Price Index. We no longer have local inflation data as of the end of 2017. This was an issue. You know, we've raised it. A lot of other agencies have raised it because there's hundreds of statutes that have something tied to this. A lot of local governments have their workforce and union contracts tied to the old Portland-Salem CPI. So these all need to be revised. This is a technical change, something Legislative Council is very well aware of and has been working on drafting a bill that may come through this committee. Just as an FYI, that just needs to be replaced with something else. The something else that we've replaced it with in our forecast is what's called the West Region Size Class A, which just means big metros in the West, right? Because Portland's a big metro, we're replacing it with the West region equivalent. Now, that means it includes Seattle, Denver, Salt Lake, San Diego, Los Angeles, San Francisco. So it's not exactly a one-for-one relationship. I think the legislative bill actually just has it replaced with the overall West CPI and not the West large city CPI. Very minor differences in this case. The one component that would be most important to capture would be housing costs. Our local CPI had been running ahead of the national one this cycle for really the first time in its history, largely due to the housing issue. Now, the housing issue is also across the entire West, so replacing it with something along those lines will make sure that the CPI used for anything from wage increases, COLA increases, you know, what can sheriff's fees and judicial fees and all these other things that are tied to it will better reflect underlying CPI in the area. It's just it's going to be a technical fix, but it's one that permeates through every single agency in a lot of different places.
Excuse me, Rep. Noss, did you
have I did have a question. Thanks. If you're okay, I'm going to indulge and get a little professional development for my other job. I bargain contracts for the Oregon Nurses Association, and so I'm kind of embarrassed I didn't know that this indicator was going away, because we use it a lot. Do you know off the top of your head if the West Coast CPI is higher than what we might have experienced with the Portland-Salem CPI? Because those other cities and areas that you said are lumped in there, they, in my mind, they tend to be more inflationary. And whenever I have tried in bargaining to get employers to look at those areas, they're like, that's not our market, blah, 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 blah. And we always sort of lose that argument.
Chair Nathanson, Chair Haas, Representative Nos, a couple points there. First, replacing the Portland numbers with a broader regional number means they'll be more stable. In terms of the year-to-year movements, or the Portland CPI, we got it every 6 months, and it was a lot noisier than some of the national indicators because it's a smaller sample size. And
okay.
And when we had an issue with the price of used cars a couple years ago, spiked in the Portland area, but not nationwide. Just in Portland, used cars went up tremendously. But so we had some idiosyncratic things that happen that then get reversed, 6 months later. So that'll be a little more stable. And since around the year 2000, they're pretty darn similar. We had some differences in the 90s, but the year-to-year movements since this millennium have been fairly similar. So I would be a little less concerned about that, unless
just never tracked it, because I could never get the other side to agree. So, okay. Interesting.
Quickly, just as we're about to head into the holiday season, we're going to take some breaks, visit family, do some black market, or black market.
We're in Josephine County. Here we are. You finally telling the truth.
From my train of thought. Black Friday shopping, Cyber Monday shopping, something that continues to permeate through the economy and has lasting impacts is the rise of e-commerce and online sales, right? There's this story, it's certainly overblown, about some retail apocalypse, right? Where the growth in online sales, it has transformed the retail industry, but it's not resulting in tons and tons of layoffs and store closures by itself. A lot of the issues when it comes to the brick and mortar stores is we have some legacy debt problems with leveraged buyouts where yes, sales have sagged at Toys R Us or Sears or whatever the case may be, but that alone is not enough to cause a firm to go bankrupt and to close hundreds and hundreds of stores nationwide. There's some other things going on related to the governance of the companies themselves, but that said, we know e-commerce is rising, and we're now up to almost 10% of all sales in the U.S. are done through an e-commerce firm, whether that's Amazon or myriad smaller ones out there. And this is continuing to accelerate. It's continuing to grow up basically at an exponential rate. But that said, it's still 10% of all retail sales. We're still going to car lots and buying cars for the most part. We're still going to Fred Meyer to buy our apples. And so there's a lot of sales that are going on still in the brick and mortar environment. When we look at growth here in the Oregon economy, we break it down and we've seen the fastest growth in these e-commerce firms, right? We're getting a lot of distribution centers, warehouse spaces, some honestly brick and mortar retail stores from e-commerce firms at the same time, and it's growing tremendously fast in recent years and expected to increase moving forward with more distribution centers. We're going to open up an Amazon distribution center here with 1,000 jobs in the Salem region in the very near future if it hasn't started already. And so this growth is fast and is expected to continue moving forward. That said, it's a very small slice of the overall retail-related employment in the state. Brick and mortar still has four times as many jobs as the e-commerce sector does today, and then all other retail on top of that has five times as many jobs when it comes again to auto dealers and the grocery stores and the like. And they're all increasing moving forward in our forecast, but we're increasing significantly slower than they have in the past. Given our strong migration trends and our strong population growth, the demand for consumer services from housing to pizza parlors to retail stores will continue to increase. However, we have retail overall growing about half as fast as population growth, right? It's no longer increasing the same or faster. The old adage is retail follows the rooftops. Well, that's still true. It's just much less so than in the past, given the shift, and they're trying to find smaller footprints. And moving forward, there's going to be some redevelopment opportunities for some shopping centers around the state. And that's another challenge for local governments is how do we redevelop some of these former retail spaces into warehouses or into transportation, you know, depot stations or into housing or things like that. But that said, overall, retail is not in an apocalypse. It's just going slower and being transformed by the growth in the online sales.
All right, so on to the meat of the presentation, the revenue update. And as I said, while the over this the rest of this current biennium, over the next year or so, the economic outlook is pretty stable, or there's less uncertainty than there is as we look further out. And that unfortunately isn't true with the revenue outlook, where we still have quite a bit of uncertainty here in this current biennium that we're still have one April of tax season to go. And the reason for this uncertainty is we've just been seeing revenue come in over the last several months far faster than would be expected, given the underlying economic indicators we're seeing. First of all, was around the time of the federal tax reforms, we saw huge amounts of estimated payments, both on the corporate and the personal side, really unprecedented, about double the rate we normally would see in the December-January period. And those haven't really gone out of the system yet. We're also seeing a tremendous amount of wage growth here. This is Oregon withholding of personal income taxes out of predominantly paychecks and retirement benefits and the like. And the growth here has been significantly faster than our measures that come out of our jobs data or the income accounts, where the wage growth is a good couple of percentage points lower and has been for 2 years running, which is a puzzle to us, because traditionally our Oregon tax withholdings have really marched, once everything's revised, have marched really in step with the economic indicators of wage growth. And except for a couple of idiosyncratic times when we change the withholding tables, or when one of our major companies puts out a big bonus or something like that, you'll get a little bit of a divergence in the two series growth, but never for the extended period of time we've seen over the last couple of years. So the problem becomes, okay, well, we know some of this are timing related, particularly when we're in this changing world with all the federal tax reform. So a lot of these payments may have just come in a little earlier than they normally would. And now when taxpayers reconcile their annual tax bills, that'll come out of the flow. So some of it's just timing, but the trick is to detangle that from how much of it is actually, you know, reflective of fundamental gains in the economy and a fundamentally healthier revenue environment. And so that's the trick. And right now we're expecting, and have for a while, quite a bit of this to come out in terms of timing issues. And it looks like it may already be starting. In October, we had a tremendous amount of refunds go out, an unprecedented amount of refunds, which would be consistent with the narrative of our extension filers and our amended returns, having paid extra at the end of last year and then now getting refunds back. And so as we progress through this next tax year, we expect to see more of the same. But there is some upside risk there that if more of this recent growth we see is not just timing related or related to taxpayer behavior, and rather, you know, fundamentally bigger economy that may not be fully being showing up in the economic indicators, well, then we will likely bring in more revenue than expected, which unfortunately in our current environment of being in the kicker, over the kicker threshold, would just relate in a large, mostly in a bigger kicker for the next biennium. So how has 17-19 changed? The bottom line number here is that $59.5 million in changing in the general fund net available resources. That's a lot of that's coming from personal and corporate income tax tracking, how that's been coming in relative to the forecast in recent months. So almost $60 million in additional general fund revenues, and then we also have upward revisions in both our lottery and marijuana forecast, and we'll talk a little bit more about the marijuana forecast going forward. The lottery forecast for this given biennium is shifted up largely because of those massive jackpots
that ran up last month in our jackpot games, which led to unexpectedly large sales.
Just a quick question.
Knows.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So at the sort of bottom line, where it says net available resources, and you highlighted the $60 million in additional revenue since the last forecast, but I just want to be sure I'm reading right. It's $1.1 billion since you made the estimate, right? I mean,
since we closed the session forecast, yeah. That's correct. That's correct. Now, a lot of that did come from the federal tax reform, in particular, you know, a couple hundred million of corporate repatriation money and the like. But So that's a mix between the policy changes and the stronger than expected forecast.
Wow.
But it is up there, and it's up in terms of the non-corporate stuff we track for the kicker. We are now at 3.9% above the forecast we made in May of 15. So 3.9% is almost twice that 2% threshold now where we're at. So it's, yeah, we're.
Wow.
Yes. Thank you.
So you mentioned how much it is ahead of a forecast you made in, did I hear you say May of 2015?
Correct. And, no, 17, sorry. 17. Sorry. Okay.
That's an important difference. Yeah. But still, it does point out something important. Early in the presentation, you were talking about how in the short term, forecasts are, it can be fairly accurate, they can be fairly good, the confidence level is fairly high, but further out, it gets pretty mushy and pretty uncertain. What is the longest time lapse between when you work on a forecast and it becomes set in stone, and then we finally determine whether we went over the amount by a degree sufficient to cause the kicker to happen? What's that time period?
So that time period is just over 2 years. So in the May forecast, we locked down our forecast for the kicker. And then at the end of the session, we roll in any policy changes that the legislature made that impact revenue. So that sets the bar just as we head into the next biennium. So then 2 years from then, at the end of the biennium, we start to get, we find out how much collection flowed in. And so our process in the September forecast, after a biennium is over, that's when we take our snapshot and certify this kicker and talk about, you know, and for our accounting, that's the end of time. Now, accountants in the state, they still move stuff around for a couple months after that, but that's where we go ahead and take the snapshot. So it's 2 years from the time the legislature gets the budget number to the time we know, you know, what it did, and then the kicker goes out the following year.
Yeah, a brief comment to that's a long time, 2 years, especially when a lot of things happen that the state of Oregon has no control over. Federal actions, whether it's administrative or policymakers at the federal level, global events that happen can affect the national or regional or state economy. 2 years is a long time. Is this something that's discussed by economists in other states? You know, what's the confidence level in a 6 month forecast, a year, 2 years, 5 years? At what point do they say, basically, oh pish-tosh, that's, you know, it's not really going to be very good?
Yeah, Representative Nathanson, that's true. Best practices, places like the Pew Center go around, and the one thing they do say is they like to have what we do is quarterly updates is great, but then the biennial budgets are harder to hit, which is the observation that you're making. In terms of confidence intervals and the like, we do have some information here on this chart, which shows where we change this as we go through the
the season. So here we are with basically one April, a little more than halfway through, and with, you know, the 67% confidence, we're this two-thirds barrier, we're looking at still, you know, $619 million of uncertainty just with, you know, just with this two standard deviations or one standard deviation. The 95% confidence, again, is now $1.2 billion. So even with, at this point, there's still quite a bit of uncertainty. When you go back to the very beginning of the biennium, it's even larger. I think we started, you know, $2.5 billion, $3 billion of you know, baseline uncertainty.
Wait, can I, wait, one more question. Okay, so half hour ago, you made, is the uncertainty because revenue is just going to continue to grow, or the uncertainty is because, well, it looks awesome now, but somewhere something could happen? Because the way I've sort of soundbited this presentation so far, and I realize we're not through all the slides yet, is things are awesome, but maybe a recession is coming.
Representative Nose, Chair Haas, Chair Nathanson. Yeah, I think that would be fair. I would say, but there are also upside risks as well. But yes, right now the revenue situation is very healthy, and but there is quite a bit of uncertainty going forward, both in terms of the economic recession, also in terms of taxpayer behavior and how they react to the new federal environment. Most taxpayers are really focused on the federal tax system, and not the Oregon tax system. So a lot of times we get thrown around unexpectedly by taxpayers reacting to things that we're not really focused on in terms of federal changes. And now there are so many of them in terms of your corporate structure and what's going through personal income taxes and the like, and, you know, and the pass-through entities and the whole range of issues that have changed. You know, it's there's, you know, even heightened uncertainty today relative to a typical period, I think.
On that note on revenue, we don't usually do this, but I do have a question from the audience. How much of the increase in revenue is based upon timing?
That's a good question. A lot of that is we're trying to weed out, you know, how much is timing and is not. So that would be a difficult thing to, I think, pull out. But I roughly, back of the envelope, we've seen the estimated payments are about $300 or $400 million higher than they would typically be over the year if they were their normal share of collections. And these wages, in terms of this withholding, are a good $300 million higher than they would be if they had grown along the lines of what we're seeing in our labor market data. And so you put those two things together, it's super rough, but, you know, somewhere around the $600 million is probably right now is what underlying an assumption for the timing issues.
Okay, thank you. Senator Bokwis?
I'd like to go back to Representative Nosa's question, because I don't think I certainly would exactly characterize the way he said it. However, if we go back to May of last year, or May of 2 years ago, I think what I'm still hearing, and throughout your entire presentation, embedded down in the foundation of your presentation, is the fact that because of labor factors, resource factors, demographics, brick and mortar, long term, there's only so much we can grow anyway. And long term, we can't grow much more unless there's something pretty dynamic changing. And that's when we see in the out years where we start seeing what we would sort of hear like to say downturns, unless there's something fundamentally changed in the economy outside of this room. You're pretty much forecasting what you did 2 years ago, saying, you know, it looks pretty good because we can kind of grow here because of the economy, but when we get in the out years, we're not going to have all of those base economic things there that are going to see huge increases, unless there's some, you know, titanic shift in the world, and I don't know, Google is developed in Oregon and we become the headquarters of Gugit and we're new Amazon guy or somebody. I think that's what really what you're saying.
I think that's a very fair characterization that we are and have been calling for a transition to more sustainable rates of growth. Now that sustainable rate of growth is affected by, as you just mentioned, by one big factor, which is the rate of technological change,
right,
which is something that's hard to forecast, but that would raise all boats. And, you know, that's the biggest chance for upside risk is, you know, a positive technological shocks is what we call them. So absolutely right. So so we feel very strongly about this medium term outlook that we'll somehow get to a sustainable rate of growth. The problem is the path that we take to get there and how that overlaps with our budget period. Right. You know, how fast is this deceleration, or do we even, as we have many times in the past, have a couple periods of unexpected boom and then a bust to get you the same sort of average as, you know, a slower deceleration, you know? And so that's exactly the issue that we're wrestling with now is really that short near-term timing.
Representative Marsh.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I have a question about withholding. A couple of months ago, when we were last here, we heard from Department of Revenue, which was concerned because our withholding documents traditionally have depended on the W-4, which is the federal tax. So the concern was that Oregon taxpayers might actually be under withholding, and you're reporting excessive withholding. So what does all that mean?
Yeah, Representative Marsh, Chair Haas, Chair Nathanson. I wish I knew in terms of that we don't know in terms of over or under withholding until taxpayers reconcile at the end of the year and give us a return. What we know is it's growing fast. We don't know how much their underlying liability is growing. They might be withholding more because they're earning more, which would be great, you know, if that's the issue. Now, the W-4 issue is going to be a pain in this community's backside going forward because it's something that a lot of states are wrestling with, and it's really uncharted territory that the federal policymakers, the federal IRS, changed that W-4 form so much that it takes away from the allowances and things that Oregon statutes draw from. And so it's almost unrecognizable now in terms of what the feds are putting out. And so now in order for, you know, so Oregon statute has to be adjusted. And during this transition time, it's going to be tricky because right now, as the plan is to say, okay, well, we'll go ahead and lock you in with whatever you were withholding in Oregon before the change. And we'll stick with that until we come up with hopefully an Oregon-only W-4 where people will, you know, report their own stuff. But what if you don't have a previous one, or you changed your job and you have a new job? Well, now the DOR is going to have to make an assumption, you know, a rule about, okay, well, what do we do for these folks? And so this could create unexpected surprises for taxpayers who are used to getting a refund or used to paying so much at the end of the year. That you know, they may get upset if this changes and they have to, you know, surprise and have to change their withholding. So that is a risk going forward. Right now, if you, you know, it depends on what you want, but a lot of folks do want some refund. So if you were a person who got a little bit of a refund at the, or got just got your federal taxes just right, for most Oregonians, then they would end up paying a little bit at the end of the year here, given our current formula. But I think that relationship is, you know, who knows going forward, particularly if we get our own and what that W-4 looks like. Thank you. Okay, so whoops. So what about next biennium? Again, this is the first forecast that actually gets used by policymakers as it is part of the budget process for the governor's recommended budget. So here's just a quick summary of what happened to the next biennium, which is also seeing more total resources. $54 million in general fund, another $12 million in
lottery revenues coming from expected higher video lottery sales, and again, an upward revision in the marijuana forecast that we're going to hit here in just a second. But in terms of the big pieces, the negative and positive factors, we have some more job growth in 20 and 21, where our advisory groups thought it best not to do this recessionary hedge, not to slow growth to a crawl overnight right in the middle of the biennium. Instead, we have more of a gradual decrease, so that in growth, which adds to the expected income tax revenue. Also, on a smaller scale, we've gone ahead and increased the forecast by expecting fewer Oregon tax credits to be sold. And this comes from some of our advisory groups in on the heels of some new federal guidance that was meant to cap off the state. They put a cap on the deductibility of state taxes in the federal legislation, which caused a lot of interest in some state policies to get around that by allowing or taxpayers to buy credits that would then, you know, be applied, you know, as a charitable deduction or the like. And so we have a couple of credits that kind of fell into this category, not like some states that have done a real wide range of private education credits and like, but we have traditionally, we've had the film and video credit and now a newer opportunity grant credit, which are put out on auction. And given that the feds no longer allow a deduction on their side, you don't get this double benefit that you used to have as a state credit and a federal credit. And so given, again, that most taxpayer behavior here really is a response to the federal law, there's a concern that these credits will be hard to sell going forward. So we've just gone ahead and cut the numbers in half for this next biennium. So not big from the budget, overall budget picture, but, you know, may influence some of the individual agencies that get some of this revenue flow. On the corporate side, we've seen an increase in the general fund portion of corporate revenue due to a revision down in our estimate of repatriation. As you might recall, a big chunk of the federal tax reform that flowed down to Oregon had to do with the repatriation of foreign earnings that businesses were required to pull back on shore and get taxed at a preferential rate. And so, but this was very uncertain how much this was going to be. The numbers were really ranged, but they're all pretty big. But there was a lot of uncertainty at the time, and so the legislature wisely decided to say, okay, it's a one-time uncertain revenue source. We're going to just dedicate this to unfunded PERS liability at the school districts. So the way that works is next biennium, the Department of Revenue will try to make a calculation on how big this number was and then make a transfer out. Well, we're starting to get some early indications that the size of this repatriated income is a lot smaller than was expected by most forecasters, including the Joint Committee on Taxation, who was the primary source for most forecasters. At the U.S. level, they're thinking, you know, about 50% of what was expected. Here, maybe a little more. The good folks at DOR Research did some digging where they were looking at tax payments for the 300 biggest firms that are reporting this at the U.S. level, the repatriated income, and they looked at what they're reporting here to Oregon and how much that's, you know, how much that's changed, and it would suggest that the repatriation numbers aren't going to come in as forecast. So for 2019, 2021, from a general fund perspective, this is about $44, $45 million to the good, because it's $44, $45 million that won't be transferred out next biennium. But it does make for a smaller contribution to the PERS fund.
So I'm going to shorthand again what I heard you say. So in the short run, we're getting a little bit of bump in corporate income because of the way the tax changed, but long term, probably not so much, right?
Certainly for this portion of the corporate tax change, yes.
So then, all right, so then here's my question. if we change from Water's Edge to worldwide reporting for purposes of Oregon corporate tax, does that make any difference?
Representative Nose, Chair Haas, Chair Rich Nathanson. Yes, it will make a difference, but it's hard to determine what that is. I'm going to defer to Chris to go bug him on that. These
I might.
Questions of this can be really tricky. And, you know, when we look back at when we changed from our single sales factor a few years ago, we still don't have a postmortem to know really what that would have looked like if we hadn't. It's really hard to say some of these things, you know, because, you know, businesses only, you know, report one way, the way it's, you know, into the current law. So it's hard to do these what if scenarios. But they do matter, and in particular with some of the different tax instruments, which are, you know, gross receipts taxes and the like, this, you know, the definition becomes very important.
Okay.
Rep. Nathanson.
Thank you. So what I'm hearing you say is that the federal government also is recognizing that a lot less repatriation activity happened than they originally estimated. I'm asking you, is there any explanation for this? Is this also a timing thing? What was the deadline for all of that? Maybe we haven't seen all of it yet, or maybe if the deadline's passed. Did it mean there was a lot of optimism that there would be self-reporting and people would initiate actions that matched 100% of reality, and maybe the actions just haven't matched what really is out there and there's still some that hasn't come back? This is a big difference, not a small difference.
That's right. That's right. So, Chair Nathanson, it is a big difference, but it's very hard to know. And at the U.S. studies, they point to saying, well, I don't think the businesses were sitting on as much cash out there as we had estimated. And it's hard to know, what the distribution of all the assets were. In terms of the timing, it's hoped that most of it is in, particularly for Oregon, in terms of revenues. Now, while at the U.S. level, you could spread out your payments of this liability over 8 years or so, you had to report the liability in 2017. So from a reporting perspective, you know, that's going on now as firms, you know, file their 2017 taxes. And in Oregon, you had to pay all up front, so you don't spread this out. And so theoretically, we'd get it all in tax year 2017. But it does look like some of it has spilled into 2018, at least in terms of the coding at Department of Revenue. These early 2018 numbers were abnormally large, so we're kind of including those two and thinking maybe some of this was miscoded as 2018 liability when it was actually 2017 liability, given how big the numbers are. So I think some of it spilled over, but my guess is we've seen the vast majority of it already. In terms of the direct impact on the corporate, there's an indirect impact, which is significant as well on the personal income tax side, which is acting as a drag now that we've lowered these forecasts. And that's, well, what do firms do with this money once they bring it back on shore, right? What do you do now with all this cash? Well, the vast majority of it is given back to shareholders in the form of stock buybacks or dividends. And some of those shareholders live in Oregon. And so the stock buybacks and dividends create potentially big taxable events for non-wage income in Oregon. And so we put a pretty good-sized adjustment for this repatriation also on the personal income tax side, where shareholders would incur more tax liability. And so as we pull back this repatriation number, which I'd say, like I said, the U.S. numbers say 50%. This rough back of the envelope stuff the DOR is doing says maybe not so severe here in Oregon, at least what we're seeing. So for the first step here, I've I've reduced the number by 30% in this current round of the forecast until we get more information. And so that also was a hit on personal income taxes in 2019-2021, as was the larger kicker from this current biennium that we're now expecting. So all that stuff comes out of the wash as a $54 million net increase in the biennial general fund. Oh, here, yeah. So we already did the repatriation talk here. The numbers are still big. The one quarter, this is straight out of the Bureau of Economic Analysis income accounting, where these are defined as dividends paid from to a parent company from abroad. And so this is roughly the repatriation numbers. And we saw it spike up the last time we had a repatriation holiday in the Bush years. Lesser than we've seen now at, $300 billion in a single quarter. But nevertheless, this is still smaller than the potential $3 trillion or whatever that amount that was expected in some of the more aggressive forecasts. So with that, I'll pass to Josh, who will talk a little bit about our new marijuana outlook. And then the new size of the kicker.
For the first time since our office was given the forecast and responsibilities for recreational marijuana, we've really made a fundamental shift to the underlying forecast. You can see here, red is actual monthly tax collections reported by the Department of Revenue. The light blue line is what we put together in the spring of 2017. And it's tracked fairly well. Sales have continued to outpace expectations to the tune of $7, 8, 9 million, 7% above expectations. And given all of the underlying trends and shifts we're seeing in the marijuana market that's beneath the surface, we're really encouraged by the collection patterns, the sales patterns, our advisors to raise the outlook. One of the biggest things that's going on here is while we do have overproduction of marijuana in the state of Oregon, it has really increased competition within the marketplace, and prices have plunged by more than 50%. Even as prices have fallen by 50%, and this is something that puts downward pressure on tax collections, right? This is something we don't have a lot of experience within Oregon, the sales tax, but we levy it on the base of the price. So if the price is falling, that means you get less tax revenue for every ounce of marijuana or every joint or every edible or whatever the case may be. We're getting less tax revenue for every volume of sales that is taking place. And so as the prices have come down, we've seen usage rates increase. Oregon's usage rates of marijuana have increased substantially in the last few years. We're going to get another data point here in February, I believe. We'll get another state level number. The national number just came out, and nationwide usage went up last year at the nationwide level. And I expect to see it in Oregon too, but we'll have to wait a couple more months. So usage is up, and black market and medical market conversions are up as well, based on the best estimates. Of course, we don't have a true understanding of how much black market or even medical market production is out there, but if you look at the distribution of the population, how much people use of marijuana overall, you can get some rough estimates of the total size of the marijuana industry in Oregon, or at least the consumption base in Oregon, and then you look at how much is occurring in the recreational market, and private forecasters, private industry folks are estimating that we're now about half of the marijuana market in Oregon is in the recreational market, in the legalized recreational market, 25% black market, 25% medical market, right? So we've gone from 0% recreational to 50% recreational. At the same time, prices have plunged and usage rates have increased. And all of these things are leading our advisors, and given the underlying sales growth we're seeing reported by OLCC, to increase the forecast to the tune of roughly $20 million in the 2019-21 biennium. You can see there the dark blue line above the light blue line over the next couple of years. And I think here the risks are even tilted toward the upside, depending upon that usage number and continued market transformation and conversion into the legal recreational market. But so far, a lot of the trends we're seeing are encouraging from a policy perspective.
Rep. Nathanson.
Thank you. Not for today, but could you produce a chart that shows for us marijuana, alcohol, lottery, and tobacco on the same chart so that we can see how it are any of them growing at the same pace, and is alcohol declining because marijuana is growing, or are they impacting each other in a way that's complementary or adverse? How's that going?
Chair Nathanson, absolutely. We've done a lot of vice revenue work in recent years, and we have a lot of
Josh
material.
Is our expert.
and to your point about the interaction between what people choose to do for fun, or it's a hard thing to know. In the beer industry right now, the impact of legalized marijuana on beer consumption is something that's hotly debated. I'm not sure to have an answer on that, but we have information on usage rates over time, volume of sales, taxes, associated tax revenue, things like that. We can send you some of that information.
Okay, and it also while that's going on, there are, through Oregon Health Authority and through other places, there are cessation programs for tobacco or gambling, other sorts of addictions, and sometimes that helps to... the purpose would be to suppress the numbers. The impact on revenue is obvious, but the more important impact on people's health and maintaining healthy relationships and families is also an important value.
Absolutely. We'll share some of that information with you. Just a quick note on the size of the current expected forecast errors and the size of the kicker. As we were talking earlier, we're roughly $1 billion above the close of session, or more than $1 billion above the close of session altogether. That's resulting in a $724 million projected personal income tax kicker. That's equal to about 7.8% of liability when it comes to filling out the tax returns here in a couple of years. While $724 million is the second largest dollar amount in our office's forecast errors historically, when you look back over the 30, 40 years of our office's performance, a kicker of 7.8% is right at the middle point, right? We've given half of our kickers have been larger than that as a percentage basis, and half of them have been smaller than that. So it's roughly in line with historical performance given typical forecast errors over the business cycle. That doesn't mean it's not a big deal. Doesn't mean it's not a large number. $700 million is a big number. There's no question. In the past, we've given out proportionately larger ones at the same time.
What this chart means by sweet spot is are the rare times when revenue came in higher than expected at the close of session, but was still below this 2% threshold. It's a rare occurrence to get right in there.
And then a quick update on the distributions. It's important to point out that we pay the kicker out in the same way we take the money in. Those with a higher, it's paid out proportionately. That 7.8%, every taxpayer will be able to take that based on their previous year's liability. So that means people with higher incomes and higher tax liabilities get a larger dollar amount in terms of their kicker, even though it's the same proportionate amount. And these numbers have gone up for the median and the average. They've gone up about $10 per taxpayer relative to last forecast, given we're now $50, $60 million above the previous forecast when it comes to the general fund outlook.
So I always like to end with the good news story, which are Oregon's reserves, that we've really never had significant reserves ever before, but the legislature wisely put in some automatic deposit mechanisms a decade ago now, and with 9 years worth of economic expansion, these things have really started to bear fruit. So when you include our large ending balance, now we're looking at expecting to end the biennium with $2.5 billion in reserves, which is 12% of our two-year budget, which is quite a good chunk. Not enough to erase the pain of a recession by any means, but a whole lot more than we've ever had before in terms of resources to help smooth the public services through a potential downturn. So while the economic outlook is becoming more and more uncertain,
at least we have this to fall back on, which has never been the case in the past, which should help policymakers navigate the next downturn. So with that, we're well over our time, but I appreciate it. And any further questions you have, we'd be happy to entertain.
That is a good news slide on the reserves. Reserves that weren't available to the legislature in past recessions. If you're not going to reform your tax code, the next best thing is to have a cushion to soften those valleys. Any questions for economists?
Well, thank you, gentlemen. We're really not trying to butter you up. You are more entertaining and interesting than a lot of people. But you should also know the bar is not that high. Okay, so with no questions, no other activity, thank you all. And the Senate will adjourn.
The House committee is adjourned.
No, I think it was way too